From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a big decision on health care from the Supreme Court, celebration and rage in response, and massive fires in Colorado. By a 5-4 vote, health care reforms upheld. President Obama hailed the High Court's decision.
Whatever the politics, today's decision was a victory for people all over this country whose lives will be more secure because of this law and the Supreme Court's decision to uphold it.
Tea Party activist Kelly Carinder voiced her fury on the Supreme Court steps.
To those that are rejoicing that this monstrosity is partially upheld, I've got four little words for you. This is not over.
And tens of thousands evacuated in Colorado, fleeing a huge wildfire. Christina Martinez of Colorado Springs was eager to go.
It's getting way, way too close, and they won't let us out, and I can't believe that they're not getting people out of here faster. There's so many people that need to get out of here.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Jan Crawford of CBS News, Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. How do you read the court's health care decision? How do you read John Roberts' vote? Who wins off this news? And are you fleeing wildfire as we speak? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us today from Washington is Jan Crawford, political correspondent and chief legal correspondent for CBS News, author of Supreme Conflict, the inside story of the struggle for control of the United States Supreme Court. That background may just be helpful today. Jan Crawford, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. It's nice to be here on today of all days.
Of all days. Also with us from New York is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation, author of The Change I Believe In, Fighting for Progress in the Age of Obama. Katrina Vandenhoevel, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you, Tom, on this day of progress.
Okay. And Ridge. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jan, Katrina, and Tom.
All right. I want to get into what this Supreme Court decision means, and there's much more beyond this decision as well. But if we may, I'd like to go first to how this happened. And Jan, you've covered the court for a long time. You wrote in your book about this long, massive, coordinated campaign to move the Supreme Court in a different direction, to more limited and restrictive role for the American government in its decisions. And here we are with the kind of quarterback of that effort, or at least had been seen that way, Chief Justice John Roberts, casting the deciding vote with the liberal wing of the court. What happened here, Jen?
Well, this was an outcome that no one would have expected back in 2005 when President George W. Bush put John Roberts in that center seat to take Chief Justice William Rehnquist's spot. Of course, John Roberts, think about this. I mean, he was considered a conservative legal superstar. He clerked for William Rehnquist. He was a member of the Reagan Justice Department. And conservatives believed that this was their moment, that George W. Bush, with his nominations of John Roberts and then subsequently Samuel Alito, had turned the court to the right, that he had made a grand, a sweeping change on that court that past presidents had failed to do. So this was considered, this new Roberts court, a new day for conservatives, a new day for conservative jurisprudence.
But in fact, it has been in large part, has it not? I mean, look at Citizens United and many other decisions until we come to this one. And there are those saying, Jan, that this was a last-minute switch of sides by the Chief Justice. People are reading the tea leaves in the decision itself, in the language of the decision, and saying, somebody got to him at the last minute, or something happened at the last minute. Are you hearing that? Do you see that, Jen?
That's what everybody's talking about, because people are trying to understand how, based on his questions at argument, he seemed quite hostile to this law. He did ask a couple questions about the taxing power, but no one really paid any attention to that. None of the other justices jumped in on that, and the court had just kind of moved on. And as the Chief Justice, obviously, in the majority, he gets to assign the decision. And it's believed that after that conference, when they sit around the table for the first time and talk about this case after the arguments, that Roberts was with the conservatives in the majority to strike down this massive health care legislation, the president's signature achievement. Many people in Washington, and this is speculation at this point, we don't know what happened, but many people in Washington, lawyers, people who are close to the court, believe that at some point Roberts decided to switch his vote. He tried to craft some kind of grand bargain to bring conservatives onto part of his decision that said Congress didn't have power under its power to regulate commerce, but even that he was unable to do. That's what I think is most interesting. The dissent. If you look at the dissent in this case, it's extremely unusual to see a united front.
This, typically, Alito, Thomas, Scalia, and so on.
Right. The four conservatives Kennedy. United. Mm-hmm. Typically, what they'll do is one of the conservatives or one of the liberals will write a dissent and the others just join it. So you'll have one justice. This is, you know, Justice Scalia's dissent joined by the others. Yes, yesterday in that dissent, they were all together. It didn't have a single author identified. And they all refused, while they agreed with Roberts on one part of the decision, they refused to join any of his decision, almost as if they were in disgust. There will be a massive, I think, discord among the justices and the conservatives.
They said they would have rejected it in its entirety. They would have tossed it out in its entirety, the dissenters.
Oh, that's right. But they did agree in theory with one part of Roberts' decision, which is, and it does put limits on congressional power, which was the Obama administration's main argument in this case, the one the lower courts had focused on, the one the American people were most concerned about, whether Congress had this new sweeping power to order people to buy a product from a private company. That was something Congress had never before done in the history of our great nation. And yesterday, five justices said, no, Congress doesn't have that kind of power. But where Roberts and the conservatives parted ways was Roberts walked over and with the liberals and said, but they do have this kind of power. They have a taxing power. And so they can get people to buy insurance by taxing them.
Jack, Katrina, I'll come to you. Jack Beatty on this, Adam Liptak in the New York Times quoting Oliver Wendell Holmes, justice today, who John Roberts also cited in the decision. Saying, and you know, when you come to a fork in the road, Holmes wrote, as between two possible interpretations of a statute, by one of which it would be unconstitutional and by the other valid, Justice Holmes wrote a century ago, our plain duty is to adopt that which will save the act. So, Jack, what do you see in this hand of Roberts? Is this the principled hand? Is this a political hand? And if it's politics or principle, which ones?
I think it's a combination of those things. You know, in 2005, Senator Barack Obama voted against the confirmation of John Roberts. He said, I can't trust what is in his heart. He said, it is my personal estimation that he has far more often used his skills on behalf of the strong in opposition to the weak. Well, that can't be said about the Chief Justice now. What prompted his switch, we don't know.
You're saying it as though you know it to be a fact. Do we know it was a switch? Maybe he was.
Well, let's put it this way. The switch from what his presumed stand was, the switch from his conservatism. I do think the institutional argument mattered a lot to him, and that has a precedent. In 1936, the Supreme Court was throwing out the New Deal. The New Yorker wrote about the new Supreme Court building. It's a magnificent structure with fine big windows to throw the New Deal out of. And they struck down a minimum wage law. Then there was the election of 1936, a landslide for the Democrats, and in 1937, Owen Roberts, another Roberts, switched his vote on a similar case, on a minimum wage case, the famous switch in time that saved nine, saved them from Franklin Roosevelt's threat to pack the court. But it was, but that really wasn't decisive, since Roberts made the that decision, Owen Roberts did, before Roosevelt's threat. What he did react to, though, was the sense that the court was going to be seen as illegitimate by the public then. And today, I think, if this decision had gone the other way, at least half of Americans would have regarded the court as illegitimate, as political, as a wing of the Republican Party.
Katrina Vandenhoeven, we will come, I promise, to the substance of the reforms themselves and the challenge they'll now face in Congress and in the presidential race. But what about this issue in Roberts' vote here? Do you see it as a move to hold the court's credibility together, to thread the needle of polarized politics? How do you read the Chief Justice, Katrina?
Oh, I think Justice Roberts became an institutionalist. He saw
save its legitimacy,
to save it from being perceived as an adjunct of the Republican Party. I do think.
Where was that impulse
that
in the last 3 years?
But I think. This happens cumulatively. Mm. Bush v. Gore, let's not forget, 2000. Half the country perceived the court as an adjunct of the Republican Party, as it put a president in office. Citizens United. We cannot forget Citizens United. We can't forget it today because the court, this same court, has now put a nail in the coffin of the needed campaign finance reform in this country with its Montana decision of a few days ago. Mm. But never forget the showdown as the right liked to portray it, when President Obama just said a few tough words at the State of the Union a couple years ago of criticizing the Citizens United decision. I do think Justice Scalia played a role. I think Justice Scalia in the immigration decision, in a broadside overreach that many legal scholars were appalled by, where he reached beyond the issues at hand in the immigration decision to bring in President Obama's recent executive decision to allow undocumented immigrant students a path toward citizenship. When he reached for that, when he issued a broadside against the president, he sounded like a bad talk radio host. And I think Justice Roberts, I don't know the man, but has to have been appalled because he is, it is his court. It is like Warren, Berger, he will go down in history. So I think on this case, what's interesting, he found a way using the Solicitor General's, the much maligned Solicitor General's arguments to finesse this. Because what he did was save Obama's signature legislation, step back from undermining and rolling back the New Deal, which is at the heart, I would argue, of the right wing's agenda these days, and not taking on the Commerce Clause head on, and finessing with this tax penalty issue, but all the while preserving conservative limits on federal power.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. The Supreme Court on health care. The House holds Eric Holder in contempt. Mass evacuation as wildfires burn in Colorado. Katrina Vandenhoevel is with us, editor and publisher of The Nation, author of The Change I Believe In. Jan Crawford is here, political and legal correspondent, chief legal correspondent for CBS News, author of Supreme Conflict. And we may have seen the outcome of no small amount of that in this week. Jack Beatty's here. Democrats celebrating as the High Court's decision went down. Here's House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi. She spoke with NPR's Artie Cornish.
I'm really absolutely delighted with the decision of the court. It was a victory for America's families, for our children, for anybody with a pre-existing medical condition, for anyone who wants to be healthy.
Not so happy in Rush Limbaugh territory, reacted with fury to the Supreme Court decision, saying, "Our freedom of choice just met its death panel," said Rush, the Supreme Court.
The court upheld a law that was not what we were told it would be. What has been upheld here is fraud. And the Internal Revenue Service has just become Barack Obama's domestic army. That is what we face now. We were deceived.
We'll no doubt hear more of that. And yesterday, in an interview with Laura Ingraham on the O'Reilly Factor, Louisiana Governor Republican Bobby Jindal said he was really surprised to hear the Chief Justice had cast the deciding vote with the liberal wing of the court in the decision on health care.
I don't know whether he was just playing to the editorial pages of the Washington Post or the New York Times. Extremely disappointing. Never would have predicted he would have been the one to write the opinion. Never would have predicted that it would have been a 5-4 split with these five and those four.
Bobby Jindal right there. Jan Crawford with us. Katrina Vandenhoevel, Jack Beatty. Let's go to David in Walterboro, South Carolina. David, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how are you doing, sir?
Okay.
On the health care plan, I think, with the no tax law, see, my name is David Breen. I was running for the president there for a long time. Okay, I created the no tax law. Basically, what the no-tax law does is increase the pay rate, okay, and then adds, more pay to the checks, okay, and I also did the no-gun law. Okay?
So the Supreme Court says this is a tax, and that's okay. The federal government has the power to do that. Where do you stand on it?
Well, I stand, I'm thinking, okay, if it does do good, okay, let's just say I'm a Republican. If it does do good, great, hey, great. But I'm just wondering how much you're going to get fined if you don't do it.
Well, you can those numbers are knowable, and you can track them down. In fact, you may be up against Jack. Do you have that? You may be up against it.
The tax imposed by the mandate amounted to either $695 or 2.5% of household income for those who don't have insurance. That would affect, according to the Urban Institute, somewhere between 2 and 5% of Americans. In Massachusetts, the penalty, similar penalty, only affects 1% of the state's residents. So that's the facts. Those are the facts on the
Massachusetts,
penalty.
Where Mitt Romney set up
a
scheme.
That's right.
This draws a lot of inspiration from Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, you're on the air.
Well, this is what I can't wrap my mind around. Pull yourself up.
Yes, Carl.
Party of self-reliance and the party of everyone taking care of themselves are against people paying for their health insurance so everyone else wouldn't have to pay for them when they go to the emergency room. I cannot wrap my mind around this concept about the Republican Party. They're basically speaking against their own ideology. I don't get it.
Carl, it's a rough line, but we got the point. The GOP, you say, should favor this. They're about self-reliance, so pay your freight, pay your share. Let me get one more, and we'll take it to our panel. New York, Schenectady, New York. Beth, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm shocked. I'm looking at Massachusetts' model of the health reform in practice, which is written by about a bunch of Harvard people. Katrina must also like. It says the same thing. In Massachusetts, what it meant is that they closed charity care. Working women like me have no place to go, and I'm tired of being scapegoated. There's so many tests out there. I pay for other people to go to state school in New York State, but I can't afford to go.
Why do you think this reform would hurt you as a working woman, Beth?
Because it means, first off, $400 a month on $22,000 a year.
You mean you'd have to pay for health insurance?
Yes. Health insurance that I still won't be able to afford to use. And Katrina's aware of that because there's a ton of studies out there. That's why I mentioned that last study that said that women like me, who, even if we can find health insurance, end up not being able to afford to use it.
Lower-income women up against it. Katrina Vandenhoeven, what do you say? Get to the merits of the reform.
I want to speak. I think one of the great provisions in the reform is that being a woman is no longer a pre-existing condition. But I think what Beth is speaking to, as she uses terms like freeloader, is one of the great unresolved debates that continues to roil American politics, which is the role of government as a force for security and opportunity. What kind of community, what kind of society will we be as a country? That relationship remains unresolved. And, you know, at The Nation magazine, we are pragmatic as well as idealistic, and we believe that this healthcare legislation is the first step, as great reforms in our country have been the first step. Take Social Security, take Medicare, take voting rights. This is still flawed, this piece of legislation, but it's a milestone. It expands the safety net, and it will be built on. But that is the history of reform and progress in this country. In Beth, you hear the great philosophical divide. Do we want a yo-yo, you're on your own economics, or do you want a country that is united in ways that I think this healthcare program begins to build? The irony is, which she points to in terms of the kind of snarky anti-elitist reference to Harvard, which is funny, is that the mandate, it was hatched in the Heritage Foundation. I mean, I don't think the mandate which RomneyCare was built around is necessarily a liberal, progressive policy, but it is one that has now been taken up, and believing in the sort of what is possible you build on, that is what we are looking at today. So I think politically you will hear people like Beth who will not be moved, and politically that is what we're looking at. I think the Tea Party, the right wing of the Republican Party, which is in many ways the Republican Party, is going to be furious. It is the independent vote where I think the president needs to embrace health care. He has not, nor have the Democrats for the most part, embrace it as part of a story they tell about the economy. Because jobs in the economy remain central to this election, and President Obama and the Democrats and others must make it clear why in this economy, where so many jobs come without health benefits, where people are working two or three jobs, where people have lost jobs, people can't find jobs, health coverage, as is in this bill, becomes critical. And it will kick in many of the provisions that even Republicans support when you break it down, individual provisions. Those provisions come into play beginning, many of them, in 2014. So it becomes an argument about the future and what kind of country we want to be.
Let's talk about the politics of that argument. Here was Mitt Romney just yesterday talking about the ruling and where things go from here politically.
This is a time of choice for the American people. Our mission is clear. If we want to get rid of Obamacare, we're going to have to replace President Obama.
Mitt Romney yesterday. Jan Crawford, how does this play out for the White House, the reelection campaign, for the Romney campaign?
Well, I mean, picking up on what Katrina said, that this is a moment, unresolved, the role of our country and government in our country. And she is saying this is a moment for progressives, and this ruling was, but covering this presidential campaign, going across the country, talking to people, they would agree with that, that it is a moment, but they also believe that we are going in the wrong direction. And I think that is why you saw so much opposition. In our recent poll here at CBS and the New York Times, 68% of the American people wanted the Supreme Court to strike down the provision that John Roberts and the four liberal justices said was constitutional yesterday. This is not a popular law. 68%, that is not a partisan poll. And the reason is because people believe if you go out and talk to them, and why this presidential campaign matters is because government's role in our lives has become so expansive and so overreaching that this health care law became a symbol for them in many ways of what was going wrong with the country. And they believe that the country and the future of the country hangs in the balance with this election. You hear that over and over from people across the country having a very different view from the one that Katrina just articulated. Now, that said, this ruling, there's an enormous disagreement on who it will benefit, whether it benefits the president or whether it benefits Mitt Romney. But many strategists on both sides of the aisle think eventually, while this was a legal win yesterday for the president, will end up being a political defeat for the president, at least among many voters who are in that kind of key swing category. Because what the Supreme Court has done, and perhaps Roberts very cleverly has done, is use the president's words that it was not a tax and basically said he was lying, that this is a tax. And that gives the Republicans a big platform to work off of. They already had this kind of government overreach, government encroachment into our lives, and that's why the GOP doesn't support this law. They see this as about freedom. It's not about whether or not you're going to be paying your own share. It's about whether the government can force you to buy something, to do something that you don't want to do. So at the end of the day, come November, there is some concern among Democrats and some hope among Republicans that what the Supreme Court has done is give Romney and the Republicans a big winning issue.
Jack, 68% New York Times CBS poll finds wanted it struck down. So big victory for Obama yesterday. But how do you see this breaking out over the next months?
Well, you know, I don't know that Romney really wants to relitigate this. I mean, it is a GOP base issue. The base is already on board. The people who are going to decide the election, weak partisans, independents, persuadables, undecided, they don't want to hear about yesterday. They want to hear about the economy. And every time he's not talking about the economy, he's off message for himself. And also, there's his own record, what Tim Pawlenty, in a crude coinage, but an accurate one, called Obamacare, right? I mean, this is so I'm not sure he really wants to make too much of it. And for the president, I think it gives him a chance to talk to Beth. Beth has called this program before, and she has stayed in my mind as a reproof to this plan, that it really requires the hardest working people in America who aren't adequately compensated to cough up something more than the rest of us to pay for it, more than they can afford. I would far rather have had single payer, we all pay, and there's no assessment on people to come up with their part. She needs to hear from the president how the expansion of Medicaid to 133% of the poverty line, whatever, probably covers her. I would suspect it does. She needs to hear that this, if it can, that this can do something for her. The president neglected that. Why? Because he doesn't want to talk about the working poor. He doesn't want to talk about that this is the biggest break for such people in our country since Medicaid itself. He just doesn't want to raise that because Democrats don't talk about the struggling people in this country.
Beth doesn't see it that way. Let's hold that for a second. Robert in Westboro, Massachusetts. Robert, you're on the air.
Tom, how are you?
Very well. What do you see?
Well, look, I think we just ought to hold on here. I'm a liberal Democrat, but I think we're all jumping the gun. It's almost as if the court was like a robber who feeds the German Shepherd a steak so they can go in and steal the family jewels.
What do you mean?
The other part of the Supreme Court decision was opting out of expanded Medicaid coverage. 26 states challenged the law in lower court. So the small businesses, when the exchanges go up in 2014, don't carry the medical coverage packages, those employees are going to drop through the cracks of those 26 states. There'll be no safety net, and those exchanges will be up and running, and they won't be in those states that have already challenged it in the courts if they opt out as part of the Supreme Court decision was so meted out.
If they opt out and the decision says the federal government cannot penalize them by withholding monies in that case, Katrina, what about the Medicaid portion of this decision?
Decision, your caller is right, is troubling. But the states won't get their the states won't get all their funding cut off. That was a problem.
Not
that
all,
was in
but,
play.
But the additional.
But this is a problem because I think Jack was talking about the working poor, and I think we're seeing, put aside working, we're seeing, you know, the poor. The numbers are staggering in this country. The poor being, you know, they're falling through the cracks of attention by our politicians, by our media, and I think the Medicaid decision is troubling in the long run, particularly, I have to say, in states where we've seen a refusal of federal funds for ideological political reasons. I mean, if governors like Governor Walker in Wisconsin refuses funds for a high-speed train, you can imagine what they're going to do with Medicaid funding. So I think I go back to what Jack said, if I could, because I do think, building on what I said about how reforms often begin in one way, but you build on them, the Medicare for All or the single payer for all is what the fight is still on to do. And I would argue that your good caller, Beth, part of what's happening and part of the poll Jan referred to, one, if you break down this Obamacare, as even the White House calls it now, into individual provisions, even Republicans support some of those provisions. The case for getting out to this country and explaining how it connects to the economy and jobs, as I said, is critical. And finally, the media. The media has abetted this problem. There was a great study by the Project for Excellence in Journalism just a few weeks ago showing that terms used by the opponents of the law, such as, quote, government run, were much more common in coverage than terms such as pre-existing conditions.
Katrina, hold the thought right there, if you would. If you'd be good enough, I have to say, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And let me get Stephen from Brentwood, Tennessee in here. Stephen, thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. What do you think?
I'm an independent businessman. I've got 50 employees, and I got to tell you, I'm more concerned about what private enterprise on the health care provision side is going to do to us than the U.S. government or even the state government for that matter.
Why so concerned? What do you see?
3 years prior to the passage of this law, I had a 34% increase, a 16% increase, and a 14% increase 3 years in a row on my health insurance that I pay for my employees and have ever since we started our company 20 years ago, and had nowhere to go at all. That's my first point. So I worry about the insurance companies and the health care providers themselves. The second point I want to make is that everybody that's fighting against this law is just unable or unwilling to recognize the fact that all the uninsured have health insurance. It's called the emergency room.
Right.
And we're paying for that in one form or the other every day, have been and will continue to. The poor have to be. I really believe that health care is a right. And I just think that we, as those of us that have been lucky enough to be successful in life, have a responsibility to help take care of those who can't. But we all focus on those who won't. And there's the problem. We think everybody that's getting free health care are worthless people who don't work. That is just not the case. There are people out there who just can't provide themselves health care. And those of us that could and can should help those. And that's my 2 points.
Stephen, we've got it loud and clear. Jan Crawford, do you see relief for small businessman Stephen when it comes to those premiums shooting up? He's pretty skeptical on the private front, but the private sector is still very much in this plan.
Well, I mean, and there are provisions in this law that are very popular that the court sustained when it upheld the bulk of the law yesterday, including ones like prohibiting insurance companies from jacking up your premiums as if you're covered based on your medical history. So there are a lot of restrictions now on insurance companies in this law that will go into effect. But, you know, one of the things I think we do need to talk about on the Medicaid issue is what the court did yesterday in terms of allowing Congress to force the states to do things. There were some significant limits put on federal power in this kind of cobbled together decision that we saw out of the justices.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, media biz, ratings down. Ann Curry is off the Today Show. She shared a tearful goodbye.
This is not as I expected to ever leave this couch after 15 years, but I am so grateful.
especially to all of you who watch.
Swimmer Michael Phelps edged out rival Ryan Lochte to win the men's 200-meter freestyle at Olympic trials on Wednesday. Both will be at the London Olympics.
Phelps is really digging in, and he might be pulling ahead. Lochte, Phelps at the end. Who's it going to be? Phelps just ahead of Lochte this time.
And the wonderful Nora Ephron dies at 71, acclaimed author and screenwriter. She gave us Harry and Sally, and Meg Ryan ran with it.
Yes! Yes! Oh! Oh! Oh, God. Oh.
I'll have what she's having.
Oh my, maybe we all will. A week in the news is what we're looking at right now. The Supreme Court on health care. The House holds Eric Holder in contempt. Mass evacuation as wildfires burn in Colorado. Jan Crawford is with us, political correspondent, chief legal correspondent for CBS News, author of Supreme Conflict, editor and publisher of The Nation. Katrina VandenHeuvel is here. Our own Jack Beatty is in the House. Jan, I want to come back to you on the sort of undercarriage of the Supreme Court decision. We've got other things to look at here, but on the Medicare front, there's a big statement in here.
Right, I just want to raise this as an issue, and based on that summary there, we have still a lot to talk about, but you know, it didn't get a lot of attention yesterday, but it is significant because that was a key part of this program, and Congress was saying to the states they had to expand the Medicaid programs quite substantially or lose all of this federal funding, and these are constant issues for states, and they're constantly protesting it because Congress will kind of use this carrot and stick approach with its power, its spending power, in the spending clause of the Constitution and say, look, we're going to give you a lot of money. We're going to give you a lot of highway funds, but you got to set your speed limit at this, or you got to keep your drinking age at 21. And so this is really the first time the court has put some limits on that carrot and stick approach by Congress. And that could have significant ramifications going forward when Congress is trying to kind of encourage, entice, coerce the states to do things that it wants them to do.
Jack, here, the Chief
Justice.
And
that decision was 7-2.
Yes, 7-2.
That part, I mean, it wasn't, they didn't all come together, but seven of the justices agreed with that.
So does the Chief Justice hold the court's credibility out front here, Jack? But behind, we see a continuing movement toward the kind of goals that Jan Crawford was describing when this big push came on to make a more conservative court, that is, rein in federal power, even behind the front of what we see in this decision.
Well, that's right. I mean, Neil Cattell, the former Solicitor General, has an article in the Times today pointing this out, that this is a potentially significant limit on, say, federal environmental laws, laws about discrimination and so on. The federal coercion, the threat of coercion may be lifted by this. On the other hand, on the instant case with Medicaid, as Nina Totenberg pointed out this morning, it's highly unlikely that these 26 states that sued the government will opt out of this new scheme for this reason. If they do, their citizens will be paying taxes that'll go to pay for the Medicaid extension for people in other states. And it would make, you know, quite apart from the fact that they're going to get 100% of federal reimbursement for, what, 2 years, and then 90%, quite apart from that, just having their citizens pay for benefits going to people in other states, it would make no political sense for them.
But the legal groundwork in this decision to say, you know, just because you've got that fiscal leverage in Washington, well, maybe you don't. Maybe you can't use it. A couple more citizens on this front, and we'll turn a corner. Craig in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Craig, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a Republican, and I'm very pro-life, and this is what pro-life is all about, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I'm very happy the way the Supreme Court ruled on affordable health care, and that's what we need. People don't want to run around sick all the time. Where's the liberty in that?
Well, Craig, explain for us then what we've seen about a lot of fury from Tea Partiers and Republicans in response to this. Where's that Republican anger come from? It's very substantial, as you know.
It's all about power, money, and votes, and they'll take a position just to get there, whether it hurts a vast majority of the people or not. And we've got to learn to work together as fellow Americans instead of hurting each other just so we can get into power. It is a sickness that permeates this country.
Craig, I hear it from Cedar Rapids, and I'd be interested to sit down with your local Republican club and see how that flies. But I'm really glad for your call. Let me get one more. Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi. Actually, my comment kind of dovetails with Craig's. Mitt Romney liked to say, "What's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander," and this his new attack on President Obama's health care bill law, saying that it's a massive tax increase, is a perfect example of that. Because I'm in Massachusetts, and back in 2006, when Romney signed RomneyCare into law, he was asked that exact question because he had the same penalty in his bill, and he said, quote, "It's not a tax hike. It is a fee and assessment." And the fact of the matter is that, apart from the hypocrisy, they're both right. The purpose of this...
But, of course, Barack Obama said this wasn't a tax either, and now he'll accept it that way.
They said the same thing. It wasn't a tax increase. And they're both right, because the purpose of it is not to raise revenue. If everything goes according to plan, no one's going to pay the tax. They're going to get health care instead. And it's important that people understand that just because something is within the taxing authority of Congress doesn't mean that it's going to be that its intent is to raise revenue. And if I could just add one thing about why Justice Roberts did what he did.
Yes.
I think if you read the opinion, he makes it pretty clear that one of the things that troubled the justices was there was no limiting principle on the expansion of the commerce authority that the government was advocating. But Justice Roberts said there's clear and substantial case law with limiting principles on the extent of Congress's taxing authority. So he went for the narrowest possible ruling that would uphold this, and he found it in the taxing authority.
Yeah, I think you're right on the money there, Mark, and I appreciate your call. I want to turn, if I may, to another Supreme Court decision this week, a mixed decision on Arizona's controversial controversial immigration laws, rejecting a lot of the law, but permitting the state to instruct police to check the immigration status of people they detain come across. In a press conference after the decision, Arizona Governor Jan Brewer hailed the decision as a victory.
Today, the state of Arizona and Senate Bill 1070 was vindicated, and the heart of the bill was upheld.
Outside the Supreme Court on Monday, Maria Elena Hinsape, the executive director of the National Immigration Law Center, told reporters she was unhappy with the court's decision.
It basically is allowing law enforcement to go forward and racially profile poor people and people of color. We believe that this is a decision that does set back civil rights.
Jan Crawford, what did Arizona get? What did it not get in this decision?
The most important point to make is that this legal battle is nowhere near over. The justices unanimously came together to uphold that controversial provision, the most controversial provision in the Arizona law that, as you described, requires
show me your papers
police officers. Yes, when they've stopped someone for another violation, they can demand to see their papers and do a background check with ICE and the federal government to see if they're in the state illegally. The court unanimously upheld that, but they also said and suggested that this is not the end of the legal challenges. And as the commenter in front of the court said, I mean, there are going to be challenges that once this law takes effect, that it does amount to racial profiling. You're going to have a whole round of lawsuits about that. So, you know, it may be a fleeting victory for the state of Arizona. And this was another decision that conservatives were quite disappointed in, quite disappointed with the Chief Justice, who joined with Justice Kennedy and the liberals to strike down other provisions of this law, even if the show me your papers provision stays. The justices really took the teeth out of this tough new immigration law, and the conservatives on the court, led by writing separately for only for himself, Justice Scalia, were quite outraged by that.
The justices saying the federal law comes first here. Jerry in Cookeville, Tennessee.
The majority saying
that. The majority, yes.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I've got to say, yes, it has been an amazing week. I was listening to some of the channels and everything in NPR, and I didn't know if some of the people were going to start chanting Obama Akbar or...
What do you mean, Jerry? What do you mean? Just to praise the Lord. All right, all right. So where do you come down on the Arizona immigration law, Jerry?
Well, I think that I think it was kind of a lame ruling. I mean, if you get pulled over, or if you're a policeman and you pull somebody over, all right, for one thing, they don't speak English. Most officers there are bilingual. And then they ask for your driver's license, your registration, and proof of insurance. And if you don't have either, there's chances are that you're probably here illegally. And I just find it amazing how people find that controversial when it,
I mean, it's just common sense.
Jerry, let us pick it up right there. Our time is short. Katrina VandenHeuvel, show us your papers. You got a problem with that?
Yeah, of course I do. But I think, in a perfect world, that would have been struck down. But by throwing out most of the Arizona law and neutering the rest, in a sense, I think the court took a good step. Interestingly, the court affirmed that the federal government, the central issue here was that the federal government has responsibility for setting immigration policy, not the states. This is a court at the moment where you could argue states' rights, no, yet Justice Roberts careful in the healthcare decision to limit federal power. Corporate rights, yes. Politically, I think that the Arizona decision, reminds Romney didn't have anything to say after the decision. He just deflected questions until the healthcare decision came down. But
he would repeal it on his first day in office.
Yeah, I mean, you basically have a party right now, which is the party of repeal, of repealing any controls on financial, repealing the health care. But on the issue of immigration, I think the Arizona decision and the way the Republican Party responded to it reminded Latinos of how intolerant the Republican Party is and doomed to possible extinction if it doesn't recognize the changing demographics of this country, which is why to have a Jeb Bush, a Bush as a heretic, is so stunning. He comes out and he's speaking to his grave concern, as is expressed among a few others in this party leadership, about what this party's doing in relationship to Latino rights and people. You have a Romney essentially standing on the side of Arizona of racial profiling. So it's pretty much a measure of how extreme this party has become if you have a Jeb Bush ripped apart by so many in the party for what he said.
And yet you've got a caller, Jerry, saying, what's so radical about saying, who's here legally and who's not? That debate fires on. We're looking at a week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In the House yesterday, the vote against Attorney General, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, found him in contempt of Congress. Here's South Carolina Republican Congressman Trey Gowdy giving an impassioned speech on why Holder should be held in contempt.
This is a sad day, Mr. Speaker. For those of us who respect the rule of law as the foundation of this republic, for those of us who proudly work for the Department of Justice, for those of us who believe the same rules apply to everyone, regardless of whether they live simple lives of peace and quiet or whether they live and work in the towers of power, prestige, and authority, the same rules apply to everyone.
High dudgeon there on the floor of the House. Holder and others saying, look, this is a ginned-up controversy. It wasn't pretty what we've heard about Operation Fast and Furious, but here's Attorney General Eric Holder saying yesterday that this vote was a purely political move.
It's clear that they were not interested in bringing an end to this dispute or even obtaining the information they say they wanted. Ultimately, their goal was the vote that, with the help of special interest, they now have engineered.
Special interest as in the NRA there. Jan Crawford, give us some interpretation of the vote this week. What do you make of it?
Well, look, this is the kind of thing, this contempt power is something that, depending on what side you're on, that's how you view it. And when Democrats were going after the Bush administration, Republicans were up in arms saying that they shouldn't have to be able to turn over documents, they shouldn't have to be called to testify, that the president was entitled to get this confidential advice from his advisors, and that Congress couldn't just force these administration officials to go up on Capitol Hill and be at their beck and call. And so now these tables are completely turned, and now that it's the Democrats who are being summoned and the Republicans who are demanding these documents. Everyone's flipping sides on whether or not this is appropriate or not. And if you look back over history, that is what always happens when contempt issues arise. And typically, it becomes a big political game of chicken. And typically, over time and looking back, the executive always blinks.
But now, this isn't typical, right? I mean, this is the first time ever that Congress has imposed this sanction on a sitting member of a president's cabinet.
But we've had Janet Reno, the attorney general, was brought up on contempt charges. We have had in the Clinton administration, certainly, when they were citing executive privilege really more than any time in modern day history. We've certainly gone through these proceedings before. And so, again, I mean, the White House is going to say and has said quite emphatically that the attorney general has been very forthcoming, producing thousands of pages of documents, testifying 9 different times. The Republicans are saying, you know, that's not the documents that we want. So what's going to happen? It becomes this big still. It becomes an even bigger political fight, almost like a game of chicken, and it's going to be whichever side's going to blink. And that will all be based on political calculations about how damaging it becomes ultimately. If the White House believes at some point the story's getting away from them, I don't think it is right now, by the way, but if the White House sees that this story is starting to turn on them and that they're getting accused of cover-up, they will concede. Right now, that's not happening.
Big investigative report this week in Fortune magazine on what did and did not happen in all these allegations in Fast and Furious. We will talk with that reporter on Monday. Jack, what do you make of Holder in the hot seat there, this historic, not just bringing him up on contempt, but going through with it and voting for it in the House?
I mean, I quite agree with Jan that it's we have sauce for the goose and so on, but and it's true that the Democrats raised the similar hell over Harriet Myers and Josh Bolton and the Bush administration. I'm not a great fan of executive privilege. On the other hand, this does look like a ginned up controversy, ginned up primarily by the National Rifle Association and even by a more extreme group, Gun Owners of America or something, that have been promoting the idea that this was a way, fast and furious, to promote gun control in the United States.
I want to say as we close out here that our hearts and minds are with the people in Colorado who are fleeing. 300 plus homes there burnt to a crisp now and 30,000 plus evacuated. What a scene. We'll look more at that next week as well. Grateful to the three of you for being with us in this hour. Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor and publisher at The Nation. Katrina, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
Jan Crawford at CBS. Thank you, Jan.
Thank you.
And Jack, thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.